From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Tom Hayden was at the forefront of the New Left in the 60s. He was a founding member of SDS and a leader of the anti-war movement. Now Hayden is a member of the California State Legislature. He's written a memoir. Coming up, I talk with Tom Hayden about his life. There's no telling how many seemingly irreconcilable differences have been resolved with the help of Roger Fisher's bestseller, Getting to Yes. Now Fisher's written a new book called Getting Together. Fisher talks to us about the art of compromise. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz looks at the work of Hungarian pianist Annie Fischer, and urban legend expert Jan-Harald Brunvand explores the story of the stolen package with the dead cat. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. In his new memoir, Tom Hayden writes, "My father's generation believed correctly that they had defended democracy against foreign despotism. We believed we were defending democracy from its enemies at home." That belief motivated Tom Hayden's actions throughout the 60s when he was at the forefront of the New Left. In 1962, he wrote the Port Huron Statement, which set the agenda and the tone for the New Left. He was an organizer of the student movement and the founding field secretary of SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. He was active in the Southern Civil Rights Movement and worked as a community organizer in Newark at the time of the Newark riots. In 1967, the FBI put him on its rabble-rouser index. In 1968, he was one of eight people indicted for conspiring to riot in Chicago during the Democratic Convention. But by the end of the 60s, Hayden felt alienated from the direction the movement had taken. In the 70s, he met and married Jane Fonda and began his career in electoral politics. He's now serving his third term as a California State Assemblyman. His new autobiography is titled Reunion. Welcome to Fresh Air.
I'm glad to be here in Fresh Air.
I want to start by asking you to read just the opening sentence from the introduction to the Port Huron Statement, which you wrote.
This was written in the spring of 1962. We are people of this generation, bred in at least modest comfort, housed now in universities, looking uncomfortably at the world we inherit.
You really acknowledge in the opening to this statement that, for the most part, you're middle class and educated.
Right. It's not exactly the Communist Manifesto. This is definitely a generational appeal, and it probably continues to be my outlook that I'm influenced by being part of a generation, the 60s generation.
Did you feel at the time you wrote that you were breaking from the past and being this group of leftists who were young, who were middle class, and who were educated? Or did you feel that was part of some tradition of the left?
It depends who you talk to. I think that for me it was a break. I was never even completely sold on left, as in new left. I was more new. I think there were some who came together out of the left-wing traditions of the immigrants to New York, and whose children found their way to the Ann Arbors and the Madisons and Berkeleys and so on, who felt that they were a link in a left-wing tradition that was very much passed down from generation to generation. I identified intellectually with what I knew of that tradition, but I came out of the sort of non-tradition of the assimilated middle class. I was the first person to go to the university in my family and so on. And I was more new and others were more left, but we all shared a belief that, a utopian belief, that we could and would and were entitled to change the world.
Further into the introduction that you wrote in the Port Huron Statement, you said that work should involve incentives worthier than survival. Now, in a way, you could say that that's the beginning of the cultural ethic of the 60s, that there's more to life than struggle, that there's a certain amount of fun and of rewards that one should get out of life.
I think that's correct. It also is generational in the sense that it's it's a hope that we can step forward from what our grandparents and parents had gone through when work was very much about survival and survival only.
In a way, that kind of set the tone for the cultural radicalism of the 60s, which you ended up feeling, I think, very alienated from, the cultural radical part.
Well, I was perhaps alienated from it. I'm not sure that this sets in motion the counterculture.
No.
I think that what you have here are glimmers of a generation feeling radically uprooted from its past and launching itself on a mission through civil rights work in the South, but the larger mission of somehow remaking the world that we had inherited. Some people took that into experimentation with lifestyle. Others went a more political route. And you had these two pathways through the 60s. I was the more political, but I must say that on generational grounds, I defended and supported the lifestyle revolution. But my secret was that I was relatively straight in the context of those times and the terminology of those times.
Yeah, you say in your book that you were as unlikely to become a hippie in the 60s as you were to become a beatnik in the 50s. What made you unlikely to become that? What was not right for your nature?
Well, I was attracted to the beats and to the subterranean culture of the 50s, but I wanted to be a journalist. I guess part of me has always been pragmatic and practical and attempting to achieve concrete things in the terminology of the time, more linear and more political.
It's interesting, in the Chicago conspiracy trial, you were in the position of being in the middle of this media circus, in a way, where both the political left and the cultural left were sharing center stage. And you, I think, were very uncomfortable by a lot of what was happening there. You wanted to have a much more straight, rational defense that was offered. What were you able to do to make that clear?
Well, I hated the trial, frankly. Jerry Rubin and Abbie Hoffman described it as the Academy Award of protest, and they were excited. They thought that it was a great opportunity for drama. And others thought it was a great opportunity for a political defense of the 60s and a counterattack on the Nixon administration and so forth. I had just been trying to leave the national scene. I had felt quite alienated from it and wanted to live in Berkeley, and I had a relationship. And I had also become quite skeptical of being able to pressure the government into anything. I mean, to me, I didn't know how to move forward. People around me were advocating going underground. It was already at that point. And here was this trial where my lawyers, bless their souls, advised me that we would probably go to jail for 7 years. And I saw that as not only disruptive, but in the paranoia that was starting to envelop me, I thought, well, 7 years is one thing, but how do we know we're going to get out? Because there's liable to be disturbances in the prison. You have to go back and remember that there were riots in prisons. At Attica, people were shot and killed by the scores. And so I had a very gloomy perspective on this. So I came to the trial not wanting to be on trial at all, not thinking that it was a great opportunity, but clinging to a belief that was ebbing, but I was clinging to it, that we had to convince the jury of our innocence, or failing that, set a record that the higher courts would overturn the case. And the key in my mind was finding some of those members of the jury to understand that if they agreed with us, they could hang the jury. That is, they could say we were not guilty and sit there till hell froze over. And so I kind of busied myself with the defense and became an additional lawyer and tried to construct a complicated rationale for everything that had happened in Chicago and negotiate between the anti-war and the yippies and put on 105 witnesses. It was quite a defense. If you want to look at an archive of the times, the edited transcripts of the Chicago trial are quite interesting.
Well, you know, let me reintroduce you. My guest is Tom Hayden, who is now serving in the California State Legislature, and he's written a memoir about his life, and he writes a lot about the 1960s when he was at the forefront of the New Left. In your memoir, you wrote that jail in the civil rights movement was a necessary moral act and a rite of passage into serious commitment. But by the time of the Chicago conspiracy trial, had you already had it with jail? Was it a rite of passage you'd already been through?
You know, I put that in because somebody reading it said, well, you're trying to write for people who were a new generation of readers, and you have to explain that going to jail was seen as what today I guess they would call a career move. It was important. You know, if you hadn't gone to jail, you weren't really with the program. And it didn't matter if you were going to be beaten or clubbed. Jail in the South was the place to be if you were a serious person. And your question is an interesting one. By the end of the 60s, had I had it with jail? No, but I had... in the South, if you were in jail, you could appeal to the outside world and believe that there was an America that would hear your cry. If by the end of the 60s you went to jail... it was at the hands of the U.S. government, not the local sheriff, and it was less clear whether there was anybody listening to your appeal. It was much more of a permanent lockup, and whether you got out or not, it was, in fact, an exile. It was going into exile in your own country. And the difference between the two periods, the early and the late 60s, was just that margin of idealistic hope that marked the early years, and the margin of despair and hopelessness that marked the end of the decade.
By the time of the Chicago conspiracy trial, some of the people who you knew well were going underground in order to escape prison sentences or in order to do very radical, sometimes violent work without being able to be tracked down by the authorities. Did you ever consider going underground yourself?
Yes, I thought that it was a plausible alternative And I went back and forth. I mean, part of me has always been an activist, and part of me has always been kind of an observer or an analyst. And I thought it was quite possible that we were entering into a period of mass arrests, persecution, much worse than the McCarthy period, and that we had a stone-cold government, and that going underground, whether it was the nonviolent kind of escape of the Berrigans or the people setting up escape routes for draft resistors to Canada and Sweden, or people who were helping fugitives, or people who were even planning some kind of acts of violence against property, there was something plausible about their case. It was not that unbelievable. And I think a listener today might find it unbelievable. So it's all context. The other side of me thought that it was based too much on a premise of paranoia, that while some of these things were happening, that this was still a country whose institutions could be moved by organizing and speaking and educating and pressuring, and maybe sometimes the pressure would have to be very forceful or very disruptive, but there was a side of me that believed that it could be done, and that going underground was writing the country off, was writing the institutions off prematurely and totally. But then there was also an ego part of it. The going through the notion of disappearing into a world where you would be an exile in your own country, gone, and not being able to write and organize and not being able to live a normal life was also part of the strife that I felt within myself.
So those are some of the reasons why you decided not to go underground. Well, at this time, too, in the late 60s, I think that the leaders of SDS had really parted with the philosophy behind the SDS as it existed when you co-founded it. And in a way, it was probably an interesting position to be in. In the early 60s, you parted ways with what has since been called the old left and started a more leftist-oriented philosophy suited to your generation, a younger generation. Then by the late 60s, there's a generation of student radicals basically overturning the vision that you and your fellow SDS founder shared of participatory democracy. How did it feel when there were student leaders who were becoming more radical and more supportive of violent actions? Knowing that to them you had become outdated in a way.
Well, I was not. That was not the dividing line for me. I think the dividing line for me was where it became a more obscure ideology. And how did it feel? It was like a Dostoevsky novel. All of these characters have appeared. If you read The Possessed by Dostoevsky, or if you read Man's Fate by Andre Malraux, what you find is that unlike our belief at the beginning of the 60s that we were really new and that we were going to change the world in a different way, we were characters that had been seen before in history, the early utopians, the early visionaries who said things will be different. And then in short order, we turned into, or our followers turned into, caricatures of all the things that that we had been warned against. In other words, by the end of the decade, somebody said to me, "Well, we offed the pig," and I didn't know what they were talking about. And they said they closed the SDS office. I mean, in other words, the early SDS had become the enemy of the later SDS, and some of the people. And I had great affection for them and closeness to them and was attracted to their determination. But they were engaged in everything that we said would never happen to us. Arguments over the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution. One guy was given a present as a joke by his friends. It was the writings of the Communist Party leader of Albania in Albanian, and he was touched by it. He thought that it was an actual sincere gift. He was so into the Albanian way, and he's still out there.
Well, we're going to have to take a short break here. My guest is Tom Hayden, and he was at the forefront of the New Left in the 1960s, a founder of SDS and a defendant in the Chicago 8 conspiracy trial. He's now a California state legislator and has just written an autobiography titled Reunion. We're going to talk more about his life after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Tom Hayden is my guest. There were times in the 60s when you were denounced by people who you worked with as being too chauvinistic or too egotistical, too much in the spotlight. And I was wondering how you would react to that, like what you would like take to heart and really introspect about, and what would just make you really furious.
Well, my first reaction was defensiveness. I went to the other extreme of trying to incorporate myself into small groups and make myself more faceless. That was sort of silly. My final conclusion from it was that it's almost impossible to make any kind of social change without the people involved showing a lot of competitiveness and ego rivalry and tension to a point where the pressure becomes very painful. It's almost as if in believing in grassroots democracy, some people want to do away with any differences in talent or in leadership or in speaking ability or what have you, so that all distinctions between leaders and led disappear. And I certainly advocated that myself until I became a leader. And there's a lot to it, because people have to have incentives to join movements, and not everybody can be a leader by definition, so you have to have other incentives than power and glory and all that. But at the same time, there's something in all of us that I now understand that wants things to be personalized and wants leaders to be identified, so that we can, at worst, look up to somebody as above us, or at best, be able to make a better judgment about what's being said. If somebody wants to sell me a doctrine or a bill in the legislature, I look carefully at who's proposing it and make a judgment partly on the merits, but also on the quality of the person and how much I trust them. Well, and that too is a natural human need.
Well, you're an official leader now. You're an elected leader, an elected official. And I'm wondering if it's given you the opportunity to be comfortable about things that you had to be very ambivalent about in the 60s, such as being a leader. Because as a politician, you're supposed to be a leader. That's what they voted you in for. And as a politician, mm-hmm. there's always an expression of ego. You're not supposed to cover it up and pretend, you know, like you,
I'm
like
more
you have none.
I'm more comfortable, but I must say that I see close up what people in the 60s were frightened about in politics, because there is a difference between ego and egomania, and between leadership and pomposity, and I think that the balance is yet to be found.
Were you very afraid to get into politics when you decided to do it? Because let's face it, politics by a lot of people in the New Left was considered the co-optation of
right. It was
the
like
left if you ran for politics.
It was like from the legacy I carried from the 60s, getting into politics was like releasing my forbidden self. You know, it was like it was the taboo is taken off and the monster materializes. And there's a real problem that, because while everybody that you're involved in politics with has none of these, they have none of these questions for the most part, they're going for it, and it is the expansion of their personal power. You are plagued constantly, hourly, by questions of whether you're being too vain or power-driven. And if you're not questioning yourself, then your closest supporters are, because they share your ambivalence. And I think that's the reason that the people of the New Left in the 60s, who've gone into many professions, have rarely gone into politics, because of a lingering skepticism, which I understand, about the self-promotion that's inherent. When you run for office, you run as Tom Hayden. You don't run as proponent of economic democracy. People vote for the person as well as the party.
Well, I think another thing that could have been seen as changing your values in some ways when you met and married your wife Jane Fonda, because she was an actress, she was, you know, glamorous. It was seen, I think, by some people as buying into a materialistic, you know, money oriented, glamorous kind of world that the New Left had rejected. And I was wondering if you took a lot of grief from political friends when you and Jane Fonda started being together.
maybe there was a lot of grief, but I think it was suppressed, because too many of them, if they felt this way, still wanted her to come to their fundraisers. So it's probably in the static, and certainly in the image. I mean, I met a reporter yesterday from the Boston Globe, who's 32 years old, who was arguing and questioning. He didn't want me to be happy. he was unhappy that I was happy. He wanted me to be an unhappy warrior on some barricade. And I said, I am what I am. And other, I think there are other people who are of the 60s, and but also it's inherent in liberalism, who are ambivalent about success. And I think the heart of the matter, we started, people like myself were very success-oriented. I was a student editor, and the other people were student body presidents. We thought we were going to change the world. Then, as our radical questioning of the world deepened, we questioned success. That became the S word, the forbidden word. And the ambivalence remains, and it's almost become a cultural tradition, I think, on the left, to equate principle with maintaining a marginal or outsider status. Now, by that, I don't mean to put anybody down or to glorify success, but it is my observation that success is a very difficult value for people who are critical of this materialistic society to embrace. It's very tough.
When you started running for office, did you go through a period of feeling like you had to deny your past, that you had to make a break from it in order to be acceptable to the electorate?
I felt besieged within myself from both directions, that on the one hand I had to explain and calm people down about my past, but also I had, because of who I was and who my real core supporters were, I had to be consistent with my past. So I had to balance continually what were demands that were competitive.
Have you thought about what made you a radical in the first place? Like, why you became a radical? I mean, it's hard to point to one thing.
Well, I want to know that, and I've written this book, Reunion, hoping that some critic will discover the real me in the pages, you know, like a person talks to their therapist or something. It's in there, but far be it for me to know. It's not that I'm left-handed. It's not that I was raised in a Catholic church under Father Coughlin. It's not that I'm an only child or whatever. I mean, there are too many psychological explanations. I think that it lies somewhere in the accident of a person like myself and others intersecting with history at a moment that there's a wave that a younger generation chooses to ride. I was an observer. I was an alert, interested, curious. I wanted to be a writer. And along came a moment when it appeared that the whole world could be reshaped, and it was up to students. And something in me could not resist the excitement of that challenge.
Well, I regret we're out of time. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks
for being here. My guest has been Tom Hayden, and his new autobiography is titled Reunion. It's published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Larry Adler. He's one of the world's foremost harmonica players. He's played harmonica with George Gershwin and Duke Ellington, and has had works written for him by Ralph Vaughan Williams and Darius Milhaud. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks feature the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. According to Roger Fisher, the conflicts that come up in personal relationships are no different than those in business or politics or international affairs. And he says the principles of negotiation that eased tensions with the Soviets also apply to the home. Coming up, we meet negotiator Roger Fisher, author of the bestseller Getting to Yes. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews some new CD reissues that capture the art of Hungarian pianist Annie Fischer. And Jan-Harald Brunven traces an urban legend where some thieves get caught holding the bag. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. The White House said today that President Reagan has told government lawyers to look at the question of paying compensation to the families of 290 people killed when a U.S. Navy cruiser shot down an Iranian passenger plane in the Persian Gulf. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said no conclusions have been reached about compensation, and there is no timetable for a decision. Top administration officials briefed Congress on what is known so far about Sunday's tragedy in the Persian Gulf. Michael Richards has details.
The White House sent Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci to give a briefing open to all senators, and both the House Foreign Affairs Committee and the Senate Armed Services Committee held closed-door hearings. Armed Services Chairman Sam Nunn came out at one point to brief reporters. Although he said most of the information is still top secret, he did reveal that despite previous reports to the contrary, the Iranian Airbus did not stray off course.
The airspace, normal airspace for commercial aircraft, something like 10 miles on either side of a particular straight-line corridor, and that civilian aircraft was within that normal corridor.
Nunn said it will take at least 48 hours to get further details about the incident, details that will come once military investigators start returning from the Gulf. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards on Capitol Hill.
As a result of the Pentagon's procurement fraud and bribery scandal, the House Armed Services Committee is looking at the overall procurement process and the Defense Department's ability to monitor it. As NPR's Ann Garrels reports, the Defense Department says it doesn't have the resources to do an adequate job.
The Pentagon's Inspector General said the number of investigators specifically assigned to contractor fraud has risen from 375 6 years ago to more than 1,000 now. But June Gibbs Brown said that's still not enough. Brown told the committee at least 450 more are needed. But given the department's projected budget shortfalls, Brown said she was pessimistic they'll be hired. The Pentagon has developed a self-policing code of ethics for defense contractors to follow. But officials admitted today that has not worked. Brown said only 46 defense contractors have signed the code, and of those, 39 are under investigation for fraud. If corporate officials don't take appropriate actions, Brown said, no number of auditors, inspectors, or investigators will have a measurable impact. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Today in Washington, federal officials announced an agreement between Eastern Airlines and its unions designed to ease labor tensions and enhance airline safety. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has details.
As Transportation Secretary Jim Burnley put it, the agreement is just a beginning, an attempt to reestablish constructive dialogue between labor and management and establish procedures for resolving disputes. In a report issued a month ago, the Department of Transportation warned that the unprecedented labor-management tensions at Eastern could have an adverse impact on safety. In an effort to diffuse those tensions, Secretary Burnley appointed former Labor Secretary Bill Brock to work with labor and management. The agreement announced today is the result of his efforts. Labor management committees will be set up to deal with things like the captain's authority and pilot access to maintenance information. In addition, management pledged that if a captain does not agree that a flight is safe to operate, it will not fly. In the past, pilots have charged they were pressured to fly planes they felt were unsafe. But despite today's agreement, the Department of Transportation said today it will continue its intensified monitoring of Eastern to ensure that the airline remains safe. This is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
Stock prices fell sharply today on Wall Street, largely because of higher oil prices, which pushed the bond market lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 28 points to close at 2130.16. Declines led advances 9-5 on volume of 190 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 38 cents. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says Hungarian pianist Annie Fischer should be included in any list of the greatest pianists of this century. Fischer, who is now in her 70s, isn't as well known in this country as she is in Europe. She's seldom performed in America and hasn't made a lot of records. But several of her recordings have recently been reissued on compact disc, and Lloyd has a review.
Annie Fischer is a small, elegant woman, but the first time I saw her, I thought she was monumental. Shoulders back, arms swinging, she strode out on stage in an austere, black, floor-length gown and looked 8 feet tall. She nodded to the audience, sat down, and began to play. No nonsense, no display. If it weren't for that nod, you might have thought she didn't know anyone else was there. And while she played, she was completely rapt, not in the piano, but in the notes themselves. Her glistening, pearly tone could explode into passages of overwhelming power. Effortless transitions showed she knew exactly what the composer intended, not only at that particular moment, but how every moment fit into the grand architecture of an entire piece. Her performance was less an interpretation than the act of living through each note. Someone remarked afterwards that you could tell she thought it was the music that was great and not herself. Repertory tends to be unadventurous, standards from Mozart through the major 19th century figures, with a toe occasionally dipping into 20th century waters. Until fairly recently, her recordings have been pretty hard to find. But the Priceless label, less is spelled with one S and a dollar sign, has been releasing a number of Annie Fischer recordings on cassettes, and now there are also 3 CDs. Glorious performances made in London in the 1950s and 60s. There are Mozart, Schumann, and Bartok concertos, and Carnival, Schumann's masterpiece of Commedia dell'arte and split personality for solo piano. Here's a bit of Schumann's self-portrait of his own impulsive, compulsive side, a character he called Floristan. Typically, Annie Fischer worked with the best conductors. The Schumann Concerto is a 1963 performance with the Philharmonia Orchestra under Otto Klemperer. The introspective, melodic Bartok Third Piano Concerto under Igor Markevich dates from 1955, barely a decade after Bartok finished it. Actually, Bartok never quite finished it. He died before he completed the scoring of the last 17 bars. Fischer turns the piano into nature itself, awakening or dreaming, in a movement Bartok called Adagio Religioso. There's also a wonderful disc consisting of two Mozart concertos with the Philharmonia, conducted elegantly by Sir Adrian Bolt. Here is Annie Fisher at her most sublime, in the heartbreakingly intimate slow movement of the 23rd concerto. Annie Fisher said after her American visit last March that she probably wouldn't be returning. If that's true, then at least we'll have these recordings with which to hear and rehear this cherishable artist.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a series of compact discs on the Priceless label featuring Annie Fisher. This is Fresh Air. In his 1981 bestseller, Getting to Yes, Roger Fisher suggested that conflicts should not be looked at as a win or lose proposition. Instead, the two parties involved should look for mutual gains whenever possible. Fisher developed his techniques for conflict resolution as a negotiator and law professor with the Harvard Negotiation Project. Fisher has taken the principles for negotiation he set down in Getting to Yes and applied them to personal relationships in his new book, Getting Together. Let's review his strategy. He says you should have yes as a goal rather than winning.
Winning has a notion of losing, and I don't use the word win. People want to win-win. I say fine if that's the way you like to think about it. But when someone says, I want to win, I ask them, oh, who's winning your marriage? Who's winning at the office? If that's a good question, then the marriages and the office both have a serious problem.
Now, another principle that you've applied both to formal negotiations and to relationships is to separate the people from the problem. Explain.
Yes, I get questions all the time. What do you do if the people are the problem? What I mean is that no matter how seriously you and I differ, no matter how seriously I disagree with you, if it's worthwhile settling that problem, I want to deal with you. And the difficulty is that many people try to use the relationship to extort a concession. I won't talk to you again unless you do X, Y, and Z. Or they try to buy a relationship by making a concession. They'll say, all right, for the sake of the relationship, I'll give in. And giving in doesn't help a relationship. It's like Neville Chamberlain appeasement. If you have a poor relationship, if you and I have a poor relationship and I give in, then you say, ah, I know how to get Roger to give in. I will demand it next time. So that appeasement doesn't work. You can't buy a relationship. You have to build it.
An interesting point that you make in your new book about relationships is that preventing disagreements should not be a goal, that there's nothing wrong with disagreements. It was interesting for me to read that, since I think I'm probably one of many people who try to prevent disagreements, thinking that...
Well, I'm worried when you say that, because we were taught as children, probably you and I, that it's naughty to quarrel, you shouldn't disagree. And so if we approaching an
area... To me,
area,
disagreement is a sign that things are starting to fall apart, right?
That this, we shouldn't, it's rude to disagree, mm-hmm. And if you're at dinner and someone starts saying, I'm going to support Dukakis, and someone says, shh, they're supporting Bush, we must not discuss it because that'll be unpleasant. We have a lot to learn, because if we have an ongoing relationship, personal or business, and there are issues coming up. If we sweep them under the rug, they will fester, and they'll come up later. I'll kitchen sink you. I'll say, hey, how about this and this and this and this, and what about that? But if we deal with them, we say, you know, let's get side by side and look at that problem. And it's not, you're not the problem. I don't point my finger at you and say, you're the problem. I say, you and I, Terry, have a problem over here we're dealing with.
Did you ever go in with the let's win attitude?
Oh, I'm sure at times I get angry. At times there's some people I want to push around, and I do it.
I'm interested in a mistake that you made when you realize I've got to do something differently. This doesn't work.
It's the degree to which I practice when I read the paper, newspaper. I always try and put myself in the other side's shoes. I say, how would it have to be for me to make that speech? Mm-hmm. If I were going to say what P.W. Botha is saying in South Africa, what would I have to think? How would the world have to look to me? Because it seems so odd from my vantage point. So the practice of reversing my role and saying on that side, and I used it when I was before I came to Harvard, when I was spent a couple of years arguing cases in the Supreme Court, I would try to understand the other side's case. I remember opening an argument to the Supreme Court saying, may it please the court, you've heard petitioner. Petitioner has a strong case. In fact, I think it's stronger than he made it. I would put his case like this, 1, 2, 3, 4. And Justice Frankfurter said, Mr. Fisher, you're here for the government, you know. And I said, yes, the government has a strong case too, like this. And the same way today, I tell my students and the lawyers I train, the business people, I say, you're not ready to negotiate until you can put the other side's case better than they can and have an answer to it.
When someone calls you in as a negotiator, whether it's a labor management dispute, a diplomatic dispute, a war.
A business dispute.
A business dispute. What are your ground rules before you'll accept?
If both sides hire me as a mediator, I want confidentiality agreement. I want them both, that neither one can fire me unless I talk to both that time. And I've been fired some of my most successful cases. Outraged clients have tried to fire me 2 or 3 times, you know. And I'll say, fine, when can we schedule a meeting to talk about it? And by the tomorrow, they've cooled off and we go on. So that is one. Another one is agree to listen, that they will let me talk with them. I'll have access to somebody with the power to decide. If the chairman hires me, I want to have access to the chairman's office. I want to be able to get up there, bypass the junior vice president who says that's our position. If I'm hired by an embassy, I want to talk with the foreign minister. I want to be able to advise them on the top. And in Central America, I want to be able to talk with the very top, with the presidents, if that became relevant. My first job, though, is to make sure I understand their concerns and that they know I understand their concerns.
Now, have you ever had to work with somebody who was obviously into the let's win philosophy?
Oh, yes.
And tried to talk them into a kind of what's our common ground here philosophy? How do you talk somebody into that? if they have this win attitude,
I say you want to look, let's see, you have an interest in looking like a winner. You want to tell your family about it. You want to write home. Let's see what the impression is. And take a labor union situation. Some union leaders want to win, win, win.
Mm-hmm.
I say, you mean you want to look tough? What do you mean win? Mm-hmm. You want to look tough? And one case some years ago, there was about to go on strike, and I was helping the company. And this guy was tough, tough, tough. And I went down to him, and I said, look, you've called a strike for tomorrow night deadline, and your terms are on the table. If you will go on the union steps tonight and say, here's your last ultimatum, and if you will announce these terms, these new terms, and you will say, this is our final ultimatum, the president must come to union headquarters and sign it to avoid a strike. If these are the terms you pronounce, the president will come and sign them. You look good, but you give us the company a lot of substance. So his interest in winning was to look like a winner. And he cared more about the union terms being accepted than what those terms were. So I can design a solution like that.
So you respect face-saving in a situation
yes,
like that?
Yes, of course. He wanted to get reelected. And once he was reelected, there was somebody we could deal with. We could talk to each other.
Have you been in a negotiation where you felt utterly frustrated and you felt that it was going to be impossible to work out a mutually agreeable solution?
Basically, the way when you're locked in and getting nowhere, I look and say, what element are they focusing on? They're focusing on my position. I won't change. I bring one more element into the picture so it's no longer the only thing on the table. Someone said, the house, I demand $200,000 for that house. I said, I think the house is worth about $147,000. He said, well, $200,000. I said, where'd that figure come from? He says, what I want. I said, don't you want $2 million? He says, not worth $2 million. I say, now we're talking about its worth. I agree with you. Now, if you can show me, what evidence do you have it's worth $200,000? Here's my evidence of what the neighboring sales are. So if he's taking a fixed position, I bring in the external standards of fairness.
When it comes time for you to negotiate salary at Harvard or to negotiate an advance with a publisher, do you put all your principles into effect?
Oh, absolutely. I go to Houghton Mifflin and I say, Houghton Mifflin, all I want is a fair royalty rate on this. And to fair for me is I'm getting no less than anybody else you ever gave a royalty to in a comparable situation. What's comparable, I'll negotiate. But I want it. And same in the office. My young colleagues come in and I say, I'm offering you so much. And they say, what's the criteria, Roger? What's the standard? And we'll have to have external benchmarks of fairness, more than so-and-so, less than so-and-so, based on experience, training, whatever it may be. No, it's very helpful. And the great thing it does, you can't get everything you want. There's no way. Both people want the corner office. There's only one corner office. You can't both get it. What it gives people is confidence. They know how to prepare. And they also know how to negotiate without being rigid, how to be open to learning something in the process, and how to feel good about it.
Roger Fisher is the author of Getting to Yes and the new book Getting Together. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from National Public Radio's studios in Washington, D.C., with a preview of All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
How are you covering Edwin Meese's resignation?
Well, we'll be hearing about what might happen next, Nina Totenberg, on the problems the administration faces in finding a new attorney general for what will be about a half a year. And also, we'll be hearing from two people with very different viewpoints on whether there should be continued ethics investigations into the conduct of the attorney general, who says he still will be here for another couple of weeks at least.
How are you covering the funeral of the people who died in the shootdown of the Iranian airliner?
Well, we'll have a report on the mass funeral in Iran and also a discussion of compensation, how that might work.
Okay, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you've ever had something stolen, you have probably fantasized about taking revenge. Urban legend expert Jan Harald Brunvand joins us with some stories about thieves who get what they deserve.
Here in Salt Lake City, where I live, an apocryphal story is told as if it's true. Possibly it's told where you live as well. The story takes off by word of mouth in response to people's concern about thieves stealing packages out of parked cars. This time the thief gets a nasty shock. Usually a woman who is a friend of a friend of the storyteller is supposed to have been driving to a local shopping mall to exchange a present. She accidentally strikes and kills a cat. Not wanting to leave it there, the woman scrapes up the cat's body as best she can and transfers it to the plastic bag in which her goods for exchange are being carried. The logo on the bag belongs to a pricey department store. She leaves this plastic bag in her car with one window half open, and she heads into the mall to make the exchange. But looking back from across the parking lot, she sees an elderly woman reach into the car and steal the bag. So the friend of the friend supposedly follows this catnabber into the mall, watching to see what will happen. The old woman goes into a cafe, orders a cup of coffee, and then reaches into the bag to see what kind of loot she's picked up. When she feels the furry little corpse in the bag, she screams and faints. Paramedics are called, and they're just carrying the woman away in a stretcher when a helpful waitress at the cafe decides to reunite the old woman with what she thinks is her property. Oh, you forgot her package, she says, putting the plastic bag under the unconscious woman's chest. Just then, the elderly thief starts to revive, and she opens her eyes and looks straight into the dead cat's face. Then she screams and faints again. This story has, I might say, dogged my footsteps for some 30 years. I first noted it when I was a graduate student at Indiana University. The story showed up in a 1959 newspaper column from Bloomington, Indiana, and was supposed to have happened in a department store in Indianapolis. But I found earlier versions with locales ranging from the West Coast and Washington, D.C. to Europe. Someone recently sent me a clipping from a Norwegian newspaper claiming the same episode happened there. The headline was, "Stål plast pusse med død kat." Stolen plastic bag contains dead cat. One variation on the theme says an apartment dweller's pet cat died of old age. The pet owner asks a friend in the suburbs to meet her in a downtown department store and take the dead cat, which she's wrapped in a package, home to bury it in her garden. But the package is stolen by a little old lady who later faints on the sidewalk outside the store, the open package by her side. In another version of this story, which I've traced to the first decade of this century, a person is going from place to place trying to dispose of the cat package by accidentally leaving it behind. But he's consistently foiled by some well-meaning bystander who reminds him to take his package. The person eventually gives up and goes home. There he opens the package again, only to discover that inside there's a ham or some steaks instead of the cat. The essential problem in all versions of the legend is keeping track of a corpse, which links this story to the legend about a family's disastrous trip to Mexico that ends when the grandmother dies. Her family tries to transport the body back home tied to their car roof, but when they stop for a meal, the car, with grandmother on top, is stolen. The consistent theme of these stories is that the thief merely gets what he or she deserves. The story may not be true, but it certainly contains a bit of poetic justice.
Jan Harald Brunvand is professor of English and folklore at the University of Utah. His latest collection of urban legends is The Mexican Pet. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time I talk with mystery writer Tony Hillerman. His novels like Skinwalkers and A Thief of Time are set in the Navajo culture of the Southwest. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Conscience, the new album by the husband and wife team of Cecil and Linda Womack. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews A World Apart, starring Barbara Hershey as a white woman imprisoned for her work in South Africa's anti-apartheid struggle. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon and Lisa Bruton directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.